At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in German Studies, part of the New Books Network. I'm Craig Servillo, the host of the channel. Today we'll be talking with Dr. Rebecca Erbelding about her excellent new book, Rescue Board, The Untold Story of America's Efforts to Save the Jews of Europe, published by Doubleday in 2018. Rebecca, hello and welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you this morning. As usual, we like to begin these interviews by asking you about yourself, your background, where you're from, what you're doing now.
Well, I grew up in upstate New York at a small farming community outside of Rochester. I had no access really to the history of the Holocaust. We didn't cover it much in school. And so the first time I really started learning about this aspect of history, which has become, you know, my profession, was really when I was 12 years old. I came to the Holocaust Museum in Washington with my Girl Scout troop. And we toured the museum and I was just blown away. I had never encountered any of this history before. I went home and I read everything that I could find on the topic and then came down to the Washington area for college. I went to the University of Mary Washington in Fredericksburg, Virginia, thinking that I would only be an hour away from all of the museums in Washington. So I got an internship at the Holocaust Museum this summer after my junior year of school, and never left. I finished my undergrad in December 2002 and started at the Holocaust Museum in January 2003 and have been there ever since. I finished my master's and my PhD while I was working at the museum. This book, however, is the outcome of my doctoral dissertation. So even though I work as a historian now at the Holocaust Museum, this is a separate piece of work from my work for the museum. This was my own scholarship.
Then how did you come to specifically write? I know you mentioned this is your dissertation, but how did you come to this particular topic?
I mean, it became imminently practical. I wanted to go to grad school. I always loved history. I mean, back to when I was a little kid and we had, I had Fisher-Price audio tapes. Fisher-Price does the American Revolution. Fisher-Price does Daniel Boone. And I could still probably recite them for you. I listened to them all the time as a kid. And so I was always into American history and then realized once I started working full time at a museum, that I wasn't going to have the option of leaving for grad school without giving up my job, which I loved. And so I knew that I was never going to have the immersion, the language immersion that one really needs to work in European history. So I became an American historian. My PhD is in American history, but it seemed counterproductive for me to do research on the Civil War. Working at the Holocaust Museum, I had access to all of these amazing collections. I knew how to navigate them. I was working as an archivist at the time, and so I knew how to manipulate records, how to find things. And so it seemed like I wanted to find a topic that was an intersection of American history and the Holocaust, and stumbled on the War Refugee Board, which is the only official American response to the Holocaust, and realized that there was no book, no dissertation, not much of anything about this topic. And that confused me. And so I wanted to figure out why.
Okay. Yeah. Fascinating. It's interesting how our backgrounds sort of drive what we end up working on. And circumstances sort of push us right in certain directions. So for many of our listeners, they're probably not too familiar with the War Refugee Board. Because as you said, there's no book other than yours now on this topic. So if you could give us some background on the board, how it came about, who are the major actors? Because there are a lot of individuals that you mentioned in your book.
Yes. So many people have not heard of the War Refugee Board. That's true. But so many people have heard of some of the things that the board did or people that they worked with. So the board, for example, recruited Raoul Wallenberg, the now famous Swedish businessman who went to Hungary in 1944 to try to rescue Hungarian Jews. They opened a refugee camp in upstate New York and brought about 1,000 mostly Jewish refugees to live there. And they dealt with the question on whether or not America should have bombed Auschwitz. Many Americans know those stories, but they don't know the story of the organization behind it all. So in 1943, more and more Americans became aware of what we now call the Holocaust, the Nazi persecution and mass murder of the Jews. They understood now that the Nazis had a plan to gather together all of the Jews of Europe and to murder them. That was something that, you know, throughout the 1930s, didn't seem obvious. All of the Nazi persecutions, it didn't seem like it could possibly ever lead to mass murder, just because Americans couldn't fathom that sort of thing happening. By 1943, it's fairly obvious that that is what is happening. Americans may not believe it. They may not understand, you know, the depths of it, but there is an understanding that there is some sort of plan. And there's some public pressure to do something about it. There are pageants and rallies in Washington and elsewhere, full-page newspaper ads calling on the U.S. government to do something. Nobody's quite sure what, but to do something to try to save people. And while all of this public pressure campaign is going on, the State Department and the Treasury Department are starting to battle within the Roosevelt administration. The Treasury Department had approved relief money through, you know, the rudimentary economic sanctions that we had in place at the time, approved relief money to go into Europe, to go into potentially enemy territory to try to help Jews. And the State Department kept delaying their approval of this plan. They cited all sorts of reasons, saying that the money would fall into the hands of the enemy and it would hurt the war effort, or the British, our allies, didn't approve of this plan. While the Treasury Department was investigating the State Department, they realized that the State Department had also secretly told the U.S. legation in Switzerland to stop sending information about the murder of the Jews to the U.S. They felt that this information might be causing some of that public pressure on the U.S. to do something. And so if the American people don't know what is happening to the Jews of Europe, they're not going to protest. The Treasury Department is absolutely appalled to learn that the State Department has been doing this. And so they unilaterally decide to go to the president. They go to Roosevelt and they request that he remove all sorts of refugee matters. That was what they called the persecution of the Jews, refugee matters. Remove refugee matters from the State Department and give it to a new organization, the War Refugee Board. The War Refugee Board started in January 1944 and closed in September 1945. And in that 21-month period, virtually everything having to do with the Holocaust comes across their desks. So it was staffed mainly by Treasury Department lawyers, most of them in their 30s, and nominally headed by the Secretaries of War, State, and Treasury. The board put representatives in the neutral nations of Europe, in Switzerland, Sweden, Turkey, Portugal, in North Africa, and eventually in London. And those representatives are really trying to use the leverage of the United States, of a soon-to-be emergent superpower, a victorious ally in this world war, use this leverage that the U.S. is suddenly caring about the fate of the Jews and try to influence these countries on the borders of Nazi territory to allow more refugees in, to pass along intelligence that they're seeing in Nazi-occupied territories, and to really do much more to try to help people. They, like I said, opened a refugee camp in upstate New York. They sent Raoul Wallenberg to Budapest. They helped about 8,000 Jews escape Romania and Bulgaria and get to Palestine. They laundered money for rescue at one point. They really do almost everything that they could think of. They try. But the war, you know, certainly proves an impediment to rescue, and the direction that Roosevelt gives them, which is you can do what you want as long as it doesn't interfere with the war effort. So sure. There's a lot of tension between World War II and the effort to rescue Jews. Those things are inextricably linked. And that's something that I think, you know, a lot of historians of World War II don't know a lot about the Holocaust. Holocaust historians don't know a lot about World War II. But when you're talking about rescue, they have to be linked together.
Right.
So that's the story. That's the very basic story of the War of the Refugee Board.
That was great. Thank you. I want to follow up on a couple of things that you said and ask you a couple more questions about it. I'm curious as to if you found as to why the State Department behaved in the way they did, trying to conceal intelligence. Was there an anti-Semitic element to it? Was it purely practical? Was it careerism, rivalry with other departments, for lack of a better word? Do you have a sense as to why they sort of operated this way?
Yeah. So the linchpin in all of this is an Assistant Secretary of State, Breckinridge Long. He was in charge of the Visa Division, which was the division that dealt mainly with the issue of refugees and of a part of the State Department called Special War Problems, of which the mass murder of the Jews fell under. He himself was a nativist and an anti-Semite, and it's really hard to distinguish whether his discomfort with rescue or discomfort with anything having to do with Jewish refugees had more to do with the refugee part or the Jewish part. So he did not want more refugees or more immigrants into the U.S., but it's really hard to tell whether he didn't want them because they were Jewish or because they were immigrants. But it doesn't much matter in the practical sense. So he spends most of 1940 and 1941 coming up with new restrictions on immigration. He can't legally stop immigration, but he can throw barriers up for sure. And does so in the name of national security. He sees himself as the bulwark of national security. So if someone is going to sneak in and be a spy or a saboteur for the Nazis, they're not going to get in under his watch. And he and, you know, many other people in the country were warning that an easy way that Nazis might sneak in as spies would be to come as refugees, to come claiming to be fleeing persecution. Which, you know, the U.S. has no refugee policy, so it doesn't get you in any sort of specific line or will allow you to skip any steps in the immigration process. But that was certainly how they saw it, that the sympathies of America might be manipulated by these supposed refugees, and spies and saboteurs could sneak in. And so to some extent, his opposition to allowing people in is rooted in that and in his own particular prejudices. At the same time, the State Department condoned this. You can't paint the State Department with one broad brush stroke. There are certainly people who are really sympathetic and doing a lot to help, but the State Department was kind of little C conservative. Other departments changed fundamentally with the New Deal and with the Roosevelt administration. And the State Department largely doesn't. It's the same diplomats who went to the same elite colleges and boarding schools and shared a lot of the same prejudices. So the State Department really had open anti-Semitism a lot of the time. And I'm sure that had an influence in how they dealt with this question of Jewish refugees and then eventually the murder of the Jews.
You mentioned also earlier public protest, public pressure for the government to do something. Wondering if you can give us a little more as to how effective it was, how it was organized, who were the main agitators for trying to get the government to do something, because it's an important part of your book, certainly.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I don't think the War Refugee Board could be created without the inter-administration conflict between the State Department and the Treasury Department, but or without the public aspect of it. There needs to be this public pressure. FDR is a politician, after all, and if there's a battle just going on within his department, he would just say, "Well, work it out amongst yourselves." But there was a public reason that he created the board, and it is this public pressure. There are two main wings of it, both within the Jewish community. So most of the Jewish organizations in the U.S. Were part of this one public series of rallies organized by Rabbi Stephen Wise, who is the most famous rabbi in America and is one of the was really the person who passed this information that the Nazis were trying to murder the Jews onto the State Department and eventually got it confirmed that was what was happening. So he has his own kind of wing of public rallies and demands for action. The other, which I feature more prominently in the book, in part because he's much more bombastic than Wise, is Peter Bergson. So Peter Bergson was born in Lithuania and raised in the British Mandate in Palestine, in pre-state Israel. He came to the U.S. in 1940 as part of the Irgun, which the British considered a terrorist organization. They violently opposed the British control of Palestine. And so he had come to the U.S. as part of this Irgun organization, both to agitate and to lobby for the formation of a Jewish army. They wanted a Jewish army under the Allied flag. And so they wanted U.S. government support for the formation of such an army. But he was also trying to raise money to run weapons. So he's agitating for this committee for a Jewish army for a few years. And then when he finds out about the Nazi mass murder plan, he really switches his focus fairly quickly. He manages to lobby a lot of non-Jews and very prominent non-Jews. So Hollywood celebrities, Broadway stars, prominent journalists, even congressmen. Bergson was apparently very charming, very persuasive. I talked to someone last week who knew him, and I said, you know, from the records, I don't think I'd like him. And he goes, you would have liked him. Everybody liked him. Except the other Jewish organizations. The other Jewish organizations hated all of the attention that he got and hated, you know, the very forthright and in-your-face way that he tried to do it. He was not interested in diplomacy. He was not interested in being nice. He was interested in getting results. And so he and his collaborators, including, like I said, you know, Hollywood celebrities, Edward G. Robinson, Ben Hecht, people who were incredibly famous at the time, to throw massive pageants, like big stage shows. They sold out their show in the spring of 1943, We Will Never Die, sold out Madison Square Garden twice in one night, and then toured the country. It went to Constitution Hall, where at least 100 congressmen, the majority of the Supreme Court, and Eleanor Roosevelt saw it. It went to the Hollywood Bowl in the summer of 1943. And all the while, he and his organizations are also placing full-page newspaper ads. They called the 1943 Bermuda Conference between the British and the U.S. What did they call it? The Washington Post called it a tragic parlay. He called it a farce. And in the Washington Post, he took out a full page newspaper ad. Oh, a cruel mockery. That's what he called it. To the Jews of Europe, Bermuda was a cruel mockery. It was a conference that was at least publicly designed to say the British and the U.S. are interested in coming up with plans for rescue. Behind the scenes, it was organized by Breckinridge Long, and the three U.S. delegates were under instruction that they couldn't actually do anything. And so it was largely for show. Bergson is right. But his full-page newspaper ads, of course, just keep making the State Department more angry. They want to be left alone, and that they have this gadfly in Washington lobbying famous people and getting, you know, his name in the paper and his organizations publicly calling on the U.S. government to do more. I mean, it just angered Breckinridge Long so much.
But obviously it was effective.
It was absolutely effective. And the best thing is that Bergson ends up being part of Long's downfall. In the fall of 1943, and this is the other thing that leads to the formation of the War Refugee Board, in the fall of 1943, Bergson's supporters in Congress introduced bills called the Rescue Resolution that called on Roosevelt to appoint a commission to formulate plans of rescue. It's very similar to what the War Refugee Board actually became. And so there are these two bills in Congress, one in the House and one in the Senate. And in hearings in the House Foreign Affairs Committee, Breckinridge Long testifies, and he talks about all of the amazing things that he claims the State Department has been doing. They've had this conference that nobody knows about, and they've had, you know, all of these, they have all of these plans that, you know, if only the American people knew how great a job Breckinridge Long and the State Department were doing for refugees, they'd lay off. Long feels like his testimony goes so well that Congress is so interested in what he had to say that there's no way that he decided to release his testimony to the press. So he closed his session, he opened it up, he printed his own testimony, and then he released it as a booklet to the press, which was a terrible idea because once it became public knowledge, all of the things that he was saying, people could point out all of the inconsistencies and misrepresentations. And so when the Treasury Department goes to FDR to ask about the War Refugee Board, Long is particularly vulnerable and, in fact, is about to be has just been removed from his position as the head of the Visa Division and sent to Congressional Affairs.
So a demotion, sort of.
They didn't call it a demotion, and Long writes in his diary how excited he is because he won't have to deal with these refugee matters anymore. But it really probably was a demotion. I mean, he goes from having a very large staff to having almost no staff. And he leaves the government in November 1944.
Okay, so not soon after.
It's almost a year later. Mm.
So you mentioned in your introduction that the War Refugee Board, they try everything, and that comes through in the many chapters of your book that, you know, they try this plan and this plan and they try to get boats and money. But I do want to ask about a couple specific incidents because there are some colorful characters involved. So I want to ask you about Ira Hirschman, who stood out to me as one of the most colorful character. So I want to talk first about his first trip to Turkey, and then I want to ask you something else about him, but we'll start there.
Okay. Yeah. Ira Hirschman is a really interesting character. He was a Bloomingdale's marketing executive who becomes the War Refugee Board's representative in Turkey. This happened somewhat accidentally. Hirschman had originally been affiliated with Peter Bergson and Bergson's efforts. And Bergson was trying to send someone to Turkey and Hirschman already had plans in place. He was already getting his inoculations. He was already planning this trip. At some point along the way, he loses his affiliation with Bergson. And I wasn't able to figure out why, other than, you know, Bergson tended to make people mad and eventually would lose most of his allies, you know, kind of shed them one by one as he got new ones. And so it's not uncommon for people to turn on Bergson, and Hirschman apparently did. Hirschman is colorful in part because he decided really early on in his affiliation with the War Refugee Board that he was going to be the hero of a story he was writing himself. So he is going to go to Europe. He is going to be a rescuer. That's what's going to happen. He is the hero of his own mind and in his own story, and ends up being a hero in real life. But I was able to write him so colorfully, and I hope he comes across as colorful as he was, because he actually kept diaries at the time. He's the only War Refugee Board representative who kept a diary of his own experiences that I've ever found. And in his diary, he writes about, all of the meetings he has and how he's smarter than everybody at the meeting, and how he's better politically positioned than the ambassador, how everyone was slow until he got there, and he is just charging right through. And he ends up making, lots of people mad. People become very suspicious of him. He was a marketing executive, and so he wasn't the most diplomatically capable, but he was really good at selling it. And he was good at selling himself. He was good at selling the U.S., and he ends up doing amazing things, but sometimes not the things that he thinks he's doing, which made him kind of fun to write. I don't know. Those are some of my favorite chapters, just because he gave me such good material to work with.
I mean, it comes clear.
And there are lots of Hirschman's. Yeah.
Yeah. He's clearly colorful, and that definitely comes through in the book. But I do want to ask you about his major accomplishments, because you did mention
sure.
that he does actually accomplish things. So how would you assess them? Do you have numbers as to how many people he was able to rescue? Mm-hmm. What kind of ideas did he have that might have been a little different, being that he was a marketing exec and not a diplomat? He might have thought about this problem a little differently. Mm-hmm. So just those kinds of things.
Sure. So his major accomplishment is that he manages to cut enough red tape so that about 8,000, mostly Jews, can escape Hungary, Bulgaria, and Romania and get to Palestine. That sounds like a fairly simple process. In fact, it was incredibly difficult. In the entirety of 1943, less than 1,000 people had managed to escape into Turkey and get to the Middle East. It was very difficult in large part because of the sheer number of bureaucracies involved. So like I said, Palestine is mandated by the British. And so anyone who wants to enter Palestine has to go through the British and the Jewish Agency, which was the interior kind of self-government of Palestine that was working very closely and under British supervision. They have to go through Syria, which is mandated by the French. They have to land in Turkey, which is a country that was very, very nervous about Jews getting stuck there, was nervous about its position vis-a-vis other Muslim countries in the Middle East. And so the idea of Turkey, a majority Muslim country, allowing Jews to enter and then proceed to Palestine, where other Muslims do not want them to be there. That was very tricky for Turkey. And then the sheer effort of helping people escape Nazi, either occupied or collaborating countries, involved ships. It involved sailing under neutral flags or getting permission to try to sail under neutral flags, which involved the Red Cross. It involved permissions or attempted permissions from Nazi Germany that never actually come through. And so the sheer number of people that he had to work through and tape he had to cut was really astronomical. And it happens within the first 3 weeks of his arrival. He called it breaking the Bulgarian bottleneck. And this was something people had been trying to work out a scheme so that if a boat lands in Istanbul, the Turkish government will let them get off the boat. They can board a train that will take them to the border of Syria. cross over and legally enter Palestine. There are sections, or there were sections in 1944 of the Turkish Airlines where only 9 trains could pass per day. And so the logistics of figuring out how, you know, several hundred refugees can land in Turkey, be cared for, and then evacuated on a route that, you know, they don't have, proved an incredible logistical challenge. And in part because I think of his experience working in department stores, he, like I said, worked for Bloomingdale's and Macy's before that. He kind of had the knowledge of how to deal with all of these entities and kind of make them line up so that all of this would work. He also benefited from having Warren Steinhardt as the U.S. ambassador to Turkey, who was himself Jewish, and was an incredible diplomat. Steinhardt had been in the Soviet Union, the U.S. ambassador to Moscow, in between 1939 and 1941, an incredibly important time to be U.S. ambassador in Moscow. And so Steinhardt is really good. And the first boat arrives right when Hirschman is getting ready to leave Turkey for the first time. Steinhardt is really the one who takes it over the what final yard line for the touchdown, I guess, is the I'm not good at sports metaphors. he finishes the job.
Yeah, he's
so
going Hirschman over the finish line.
Had all
line,
of the bureaucracy lined up, but that last minute, like, now this is real. It's not theoretical anymore. There's a boat that just arrived out of the blue. What do we do? You know, in 1942, a boat had arrived in Turkey and sat in the harbor with nearly 1,000 refugees on board for over a month. And the Turks never let them land. And they were towed back out to sea, to the Black Sea. And the boat was destroyed. And there was one survivor of that ship. It was a boat called the Struma. And since the Struma had met its fate, its incredibly tragic fate in 1942, the Turks had not let any refugee boats arrive at all. And so in the spring of 1944, when one shows up, suddenly it becomes real again that we are now going to do this. And over the course of 1944, at least 10 boats arrive, some carrying several hundred, some carrying 700-800 refugees, all of whom are permitted to land, and all of whom are able to legally enter Palestine, despite the fact that the white paper, which limited Jewish immigration to Palestine, had technically expired. And the British were officially saying that no Jewish immigration was going to be allowed into Palestine anymore. The War Refugee Board really helped grease the wheels to allow that to happen. So that is really Hirschman's biggest success. He feels like his biggest success is saving the Jews of Transnistria, which was an area in now southern Ukraine, but at that point was part of Romania, where the Nazis and the Romanians had dumped about 100,000 Jews. Of them, you know, only several thousand, or, well, 50,000 were left, at least according to what Hirschman thinks. It's actually was far fewer at that point. But in the spring of 1944, Hirschman negotiates with the Romanian ministers to release the Jews from Transnistria. What he doesn't realize is that the Jews had already been being released from Transnistria and were allowed to return to Romania proper. And so he thinks it's his doing. He thinks that he has successfully manipulated the Romanian diplomats to allow the Jews to escape. In reality, it was already happening, and the Romanians just allowed him to believe that this was because of his requests. It was a good way to get some points with the U.S. government without actually changing any of their policies.
Right, because they were in the midst of changing sides, right, at this point, the Romanians.
Yeah, they're trying to change sides.
Yeah.
And it's easy to try to change sides when the Soviets are on the border. It's a good time to do it.
Right. So they were trying to score some points by perceiving, you know, that Jews are being let go while they're trying to change sides. So, okay, so it was...
Right.
You know, I want to ask you another follow-up about turkey specifically. And certainly I understand that you probably didn't go to Turkey and look at Turkish sources and things like that. But turkey in your book actually doesn't come off so bad. I got the sense that, you know, they kind of wanted to help, but they were always in these pretty awkward positions.
Mm-hmm.
And then just like logistical problems, like what struck me is they wanted the United States to guarantee the replacement of a boat if it was lost, because they didn't have very many boats. I mean, they were an emerging country. You know, the Ottoman Empire had collapsed not too long before. So was it more practical reasons as to why they sort of resisted helping? Because it didn't come off to me like they were really trying to be obstructionist, but it seemed like they just had all these factors going against them.
No, I think that's right. And that comes through really strongly in the story that you mentioned. So Hirschman really wants a boat. He wants his own refugee boat. The ones that were arriving were largely paid for by the American Jewish Joint Distribution Committee, and they were smaller Bulgarian boats, some wooden, some in such bad shape that they're destroyed over the course of that year by a storm or destroyed in some other way. Sorry. So they, Hirschman really wants a boat of his own, of course. Stop calling me. Sorry about that.
That's
so
all right.
Hirschman wants a boat of his own, and he tries to get one. He tries to get the Swedish to give him or to lend him a boat. He tries to get the Turkish government to lend him a boat. And Turkey responds and says, well, we will lend you a passenger boat. You can use it. But we need some sort of guarantee from the U.S. government that if the boat is destroyed or damaged, that the U.S. government will replace it with another passenger boat. We don't need a cargo ship. We need a passenger boat. And the War Refugee Board initially balks at the delays that they feel like the Turkish government is somehow being obstructionist in this request. And Steinhardt writes back a very strongly worded cable saying, it's amazing how the U.S. says that we have all of this shipping, that we are bragging about how many boats, how many guns, how many ships, how many planes that we can create. And we don't understand that Turkey, I write the exact number, I think it's six.
Turkey has six
passenger vessels in its entire fleet, six, and we can't guarantee them replacement of one passenger vessel, one-sixth of their entire fleet, their entire passenger fleet. And it is entirely understandable that they would balk at lending this to us. We are a superpower. They are Turkey. And they're giving up much more than we're asking. So I trust Steinhardt's, I trust Steinhardt to be fair. I've read a lot of his work and of his writing, and he is a very astute person. And if he's, as a representative of the U.S. government, is sticking up for Turkey in the face of the U.S. government, then Turkey is actually trying really hard. Because Steinhardt wouldn't have pulled punches about that.
Yeah.
And there's really not a lot that I see where Turkey is actively trying to be obstructionist. Turkey is in a geographically incredibly awkward place. And by the summer of 1944, when Turkey leaves neutrality and joins the Allies, they are incredibly concerned that the Nazis are going to invade. You know, one of the U.S. military attachés puts it at a 50-50 chance. He calls everybody together and tells them that Turkey's about to leave neutrality and that they might all be bombed in the next day or two. And it doesn't happen. We know that now. But Turkey is in a really difficult position. And as a majority Muslim country, an emergent Muslim country, so it is in a weird position.
Right. And then I'm sure they're also concerned about submarines and all the other things going on.
Right.
And because you do mention that a boat is sunk by a submarine, although it turns out to be a Soviet submarine.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, I was struck by the boats, the boat problem, and that we wouldn't guarantee them a boat. So I definitely wanted to make sure I asked you about that.
Yeah, they kind of sheepishly do. Like, once Steinhardt kind of yells through diplomatic cable, the board never mentions it again and kind of sheepishly sends the guarantee really fast. But Turkey never provides a boat. They reserve one for the board, but they can never get the proper official permissions to allow it to sail.
So also related to Hirschman is the first time that a representative of the Nazis tried to ransom Jews for materials, for goods, trucks.
The first time that the U.S. is involved anyway. There are times throughout the war, but this is the first time the U.S. starts to learn about ransoming.
And so I didn't know anything of this, the first story with Joel Brandt.
Joel Brand, yeah.
Brand. So if you could talk a little bit about this and just follow up with how common were these? Because everybody hears about the famous one with Eichmann and the 10,000 trucks and all that. But was this something that the Nazis at this point in the war, different factions maybe within the party and Nazi leadership were trying to do actively?
It was, especially as it became clear that the Nazis were going to lose, that the U.S. Might be more willing to give up some war material in exchange for Jews. So the Eichmann and the 10,000 trucks, that actually is the Joel Brand story. It is an incredibly that summer of 1944 and fall, as the U.S. is getting kind of tangentially involved in ransom negotiations, it becomes incredibly complicated. There's a whole story where the War Refugee Board's representative in Switzerland, Roswell McClelland, who was a Quaker aid worker, he wasn't himself Quaker, but he worked for the Quakers, an aid worker with the Quakers, gets incredibly confused about all of these different ransom negotiations being floated and what people are telling him, and demanding, you know, we need this money now because 2,000 people are going to be sent to Poland, or they'll be sent to Spain to freedom, and we need this money. You know, it becomes just chaos. The first ransom issue that the U.S. is dealing with is Joel Brand. So in mid-May 1944, a Hungarian Jewish man named Joel Brand arrives suddenly in Istanbul. He gets off a plane that is coming from Turkey or from Nazi-occupied territory. He's coming on false papers, and he's immediately arrested and starts negotiating with representatives of Jewish organizations and with the British, who the Turkish turn him over to. And he claims that he is coming from Budapest and he has a deal that Eichmann and some of Eichmann's aides are willing to strike, that becomes known as blood for goods. And the details of the deal change based on the telling and based on, you know, Brand doesn't have this written down, so he tells people different things at different times. But it's you know, kind of some standard stuff. We want coffee, we want tea, we want cocoa, we want bandages. But the kicker is that they wanted 10,000 trucks. And according to Brand, the Nazis would promise not to use the trucks on the Western Front. They would only use the trucks against the Soviets. This rouses a lot of suspicion. Not the least of which because this is war material, and one of the board's charges is that they couldn't do anything that would prolong the war. So you definitely can't provide our enemy with war equipment. That would certainly prolong the war. But it also became clear that the Brand offer might be an attempt to sow discord among the Allies. So if the U.S. and the British know about this plan and aren't telling the Soviets will get suspicious that the Western Allies might be considering giving up the trucks. And so unilaterally in July 1944, the British publicized the deal. And they call it, you know, a horrific deal. There's no way we would ever do this. and we would certainly never give up our Soviet allies in this way. So that kind of kills the Joel Brand deal, at least publicly. The Nazis sense that the Americans are maybe not willing to pay right off, but they're willing to at least have a discussion. And so they approach the board again, or they approach representatives, American representatives, to try to keep these negotiations going. Not specifically the Joel Brand negotiation. Brand is now in British custody. He is out of the way. He can't be the negotiator anymore. But the Nazis are willing to send somebody else if the Americans are willing to send somebody else. And so that is how Sally Meyer gets involved. Sally Meyer was the representative of the American Jewish Joint Distribution Committee. He was a Swiss businessman who owned a lace manufacturing firm in a small town in Switzerland. And he is tasked with resuming these negotiations. So in August 1944, he meets with a number of Nazi officers, including Kurt Becker, who personally worked for Adolf Eichmann. And this starts a chain of negotiations that carries on for about 6 months, in which Meyer is trying to string them along with the information and behind the scenes aid of Roswell McClelland, the board's representative in Switzerland, who is acting as a liaison and trying to provide backup, and so that Meyer can show that the U.S. is behind the negotiations, that the Americans are willing to consider doing all of this. Meyer, like I said, is a Swiss lace manufacturer. Roswell McClelland was 30 years old. So these are two very inexperienced people to be dealing with high-ranking Nazis who are promising the survival of the Jews of Hungary, the remaining Jews of Hungary, in exchange for these negotiations. So it is very high stakes. They carried on for 6 months.
Wow. I was struck as I was going through your book with all the characters, just how young they all were, many of them. And it's remarkable that they were able to accomplish what they did, given their youth and their experience, I guess, lack of experience. It's a good transition because I do want to make sure I ask you about Hungary. It takes up a prominent place in the book. I want to not ask you about the specifics of the Hungarian Holocaust. I think most people probably know a little something about that. But I want to know how Nazi action in Hungary changes the board itself. Does this send them into sort of panic? What do they try to do about this situation, which is rapidly deteriorating? So if you could just speak to that a little bit.
Yeah, of course. So when the board is created in January 1944, and Hungary is not occupied by Nazi Germany in January 1944. And so Hungary is actually a place of refuge that the board considers. So one of the first licenses that they give, one of the first permissions for an American aid organization to send money into Nazi territory, is for an Orthodox organization to send money to Poland to help Jews escape to Hungary. So Poland is occupied, Hungary was not. And Hungary was home to about 800,000 either Hungarian Jews or people who had escaped to Hungary during the war, who were living fairly peaceably. You know, Jewish men could be picked up for forced labor, but beyond that, you know, they weren't deported. They hadn't been deported. This changes in March 1944. So Hungary had been teetering on turning over to the Allies. And to prevent that, Nazi Germany invaded Hungary in the middle of March 1944. So everything that is happening to, or that had happened over the course of years to Jews in Germany or to Jews in Poland, happens in a matter of weeks to Jews in Hungary. The board panics because This was a captive population of about 800,000 people who are now under the fate and under the control of Nazi Germany. And so the board really sees Hungary as the last intact Jewish community that could still be saved. And they're correct. Like I said, it was 800,000 people who had not yet been subjected to Nazi occupation. So the board starts a psychological warfare campaign. They start pressuring the neutral nations to send information about what's going on in the interior of Hungary. They end up sending Raoul Wallenberg to Budapest in the summer of 1944. They start sending much more aid money and trying to rely on underground channels to figure out exactly what is happening in Hungary so that they can try to stop it. The deportations in Hungary from the countryside happen so fast that the board really doesn't have much of an impact on them. But in July, those deportations end. They end in part because the Allies have started to bomb Budapest, and in part because of the psychological warfare campaign that the War Refugee Board is raising in Hungary, trying to remind people that the war is going to end, the Allies will be victorious, and why become a war criminal at this late date? So many of their projects are focused on Hungary because they felt like they could actually make a difference there.
just a few more questions about the book. Overall, how would you assess the overall effectiveness of the War Refugee Board?
The phrase that a lot of people use when they talk about the War Refugee Board is too little and too late. And I have a problem with that in the sense of, I think if you're talking about all of American response to the Holocaust, if you're looking at 1933 to 1945, yes, the War Refugee Board in itself, the creation of it and the things that they're doing is too little and too late in terms of the scope of the Holocaust and what the U.S. could have done over this 12-year period. You know, the efforts of the board are important, but they're coming very late in this period and it's too little. In itself, though, the War Refugee Board is not too little and too late. I don't like the assessment of too little when you're just looking at the board, because what is not too little, you know, except for stopping it and stopping the Holocaust entirely, everything is too little. And too late is relative and can only be determined in hindsight. The board, in the context of 1944, they are doing everything they possibly can think of to try to save people. They're working tremendously hard in a very difficult situation, and one that is changing all the time based on the war, based on the actions of the Nazis, based on the actions of the Allies, and all of the other governments and organizations that they're dealing with. They're juggling an awful lot, and they really are doing the best they can. And so I don't want to diminish their work, but had the U.S. done more earlier, there are many more people who likely could have been saved. Within the context of 1944, the U.S. is doing more than any other country in the world. And I find the War Refugee Board to be a success, but overall American response to not be a success. Does that make sense?
Yes. No, like, I think that
overall,
comes
1933 to 45, not a success. The War Refugee Board itself, for what it was and in the context of what it was, you know, they saved tens of thousands of lives, which in 1944 is not small. It was a very difficult time. And, you know, by the time the board's created, 5 million Jews have already been killed. Had the board not been created, there would have been more people killed. That is almost certain.
And I do want to just a remark. One of the things that struck me when I was reading the book is that how committed the members of this board were to this task. This wasn't, mm-hmm. You never got the sense that this was sort of on their back burner. Like they really did try to rescue as many people as possible. They were very committed to it. So when you say that the board itself was sort of as successful as it could be, I mean, part of it is definitely the character of the people on it who took this very seriously.
Yeah, I didn't know that when I started working on it. I wasn't sure if this was a board where everyone, you know, was working their 9 to 5 or, you know, whether this was a group of committed people. And I'm incredibly impressed and aspire to be more like them.
Yeah, I mean, they were a remarkable group of people. Last question about the book. For our listeners, what are the one or two things about your book, if they are listening to this interview or pick it up and read it, that you really want them to take away from it?
I want them to take away that rescue is complicated, and that trying to help people overseas is always going to be complicated, but it doesn't mean we shouldn't do it. I think there's a tendency to look back at the Holocaust and say, what we should have done is so easy. We should have saved them, and not get into the how complicated that was. We just look back and kind of dismiss it and say, you know, for anti-Semitic reasons, we could have saved them and we didn't. We could have stopped the Holocaust and we didn't. That's not true. We probably could not have stopped it once it started. I can't think of a way that we could have stopped the Holocaust save for winning the war, which the Allies do. Could we have mitigated it earlier? Yes, but stopped it? No. You know, it's always complicated, and it was an incredibly complex time. You know, the members of the board staff have brothers and fathers and sons who are fighting and dying in the war, and we can't look at places like Syria now and say it's too complicated. There's nothing we can do. We should not have that excuse. The Holocaust is not the easy answer, and our efforts today are just too complicated for us to endure. The Holocaust was an incredibly complex answer. You know, the work that they were doing is incredibly nuanced and complex and involves a lot of factors, just as the challenges that we face today are. But if they could find it to save lives, we can find it to save lives. I'm not quite sure how. I don't have the intelligence, the behind the scenes intelligence. I don't know what's happening, you know, on the ground in Syria, but I don't know that there's an organization like the War Refugee Board in place today to try to structure an official American response. And I think there probably should be.
Okay. I would agree with you. I think that's a great thing that people should take away from this book. Before I let you go, I'm just curious if you are working on anything now. I know you have a full-time job at the museum, but do you have side projects, plans on writing another manuscript?
I would love to write another book. I have a couple of things that I'm playing with. So this book came out about 6 weeks ago. And I'm just starting kind of to be able to travel. The museum just opened a major new exhibition on American response to the Holocaust, which I served as a historian on. So that opened about 2 weeks after the book came out. And so I've been kind of wrapped up in the opening of the exhibit for the past month or so. So I'm going to start to get on the road with this book in the next couple of weeks. And I'm excited about that. And information about where I'll be will be up on my website, which is RebeccaErbelding.com. But I have a couple of projects in mind, but I need to delve into the archives. I mean, this book is entirely based on archival sources, and that's my happy place. I don't always trust secondary literature. Not that historians don't do a great job, but I like to see the original documents myself. And so if I have a book coming out, it will be, you know, a few years down the line, because I need to get into the archives and get dusty
Sure.
for a little while and,
Sure.
and see what I come up with. But I have a couple of ideas still based in World War II and in the U.S. government.
Okay. Well, there's no pressure. You know, take your time. But I hope when you do come up with another book, I can have you back on the show to talk about it. I really enjoyed this. I really also really liked this book. I would encourage everybody listening to go out and get it, read it. Definitely check your website and see if there are around any places you'll be speaking about it. I want to thank you again for agreeing to be on the show. And I also want to thank
everybody. Yeah, thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome. It was a pleasure. I also want to thank everybody for listening. And we will see you all next time.